Good afternoon, KDTH listeners, and welcome to Voices of the Tri-States, Dubuque's award-winning radio magazine with your host, Cindy Coleman. Cindy will be interviewing national, state, and area lawmakers, as well as community leaders, organization spokespersons, and other interesting guests. If you have a question concerning today's show, please call the KDTH studio lines at 690-1370. And now, here's the host of Voices of the Tri-States,
And good afternoon, Tri-States, and welcome to this edition of your radio magazine, Voices of the Tri-States. Today, we are talking federal issues. Joining us by phone, I have Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. And, Senator, good afternoon. How are you today?
Oh, I'm glad to be with you. I was in your part of the state yesterday up in Waukon and other, Winneshe County and Cresco, and let's see, Owine and the other counties up there.
Okay,
for county meeting.
Yeah, it was this swing. I think it was like 16 different meetings. That sound about right? Or
yeah, but I just had 5 yesterday. Today I'm doing everything by phone. Tomorrow I'll be in central Iowa, and then Thursday and Friday in eastern Iowa.
Okay. You know, Senator, I'm always impressed by that. You make every county at least once a year, if not more. And boy, I'll tell you, that's a tedious schedule for just about anybody, but boy, you've been doing it for a long time, and I'm telling you, Senator, you still must have that passion inside of you.
Well, I like my work, and part of my work, besides voting in Washington and doing the things that you have to do there, I have a responsibility to promote the principle of representative government. If you're going to have that, you got to have dialogue between those of us that are elected and the people we serve, and so that's why I have these county meetings.
All righty. Well, Senator, I'm going to jump into it with our questions here. Of course, the world's eyes looking at this disappearance of this Malaysian jet that's been gone now, I believe, 10 days, something like this. And the question begs for our government, I guess, of how involved should we be in this search? I know there are American citizens that were on board, I think 4 or 5, but how involved should we get? Should we be more involved, less involved? What's your take on this?
First of all, I think we're probably very deeply involved and probably should be if we think there's terrorist activity, because if there was terrorism connected to that, we know that terrorists are after Americans, and not just the ones that were on that plane, but for other reasons. I think we're actively involved because we aren't hearing so much from our people. That seems to me an indication that we would be deeply involved. You hear a lot on television, and I'll tell you, I've heard so much on television and really nothing new in 8 or 9 days, and it's one of these things where I hesitate to talk to you about it because I know senators have almost a compelling reason to talk about everything they don't know anything about. And since I don't know much about this other than what I've seen on television, and our people aren't talking a whole lot, I think I just reserve judgment until these so-called experts get some unanimity of what they're saying.
Exactly, Senator. And I guess maybe that's the surprise, or maybe it's just that it kind of caught us, you know, off guard in the sense that it seemed like there was some more information that the Malaysian government themselves had and didn't release until recently, which, again, frustrating for anybody in an investigation when some of the critical parts of, you know, at what time did this, you know, plane go off the radar, who was on board, what were the pilots doing, you bet the frustration with everyone out there. And so I can certainly understand your, you know, reserving judgment because the information just isn't flowing right now.
Yeah. I do think it's very important that we be involved because I think we have gone through these things and investigated these sorts of accidents in the past, if this is an accident, and we probably have some expertise that Malaysia doesn't have, and I hope they welcome our help, and if they don't want to cooperate, of course, they will be of less help to them, but maybe they're waking up to the fact that they need some help.
Let's switch gears a little bit, talking international politics again, though, the Ukraine and Russia. Things continue to escalate over there. I heard some words from Putin today talking about annexing Crimea, the region there. Senator, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's a more serious thing than just Crimea. When the upper house of the Russian parliament has passed a declaration of war Now, I don't know war against who, probably Ukraine, but any Russian parliament issuing a declaration of war, I think we have to take this as a very serious matter. I think also you have to look at what Putin has said as far back as 2005. He said the recreation of the Soviet Union was important to him, and the dissolution, in his own words, were the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. So you know where he's coming from. And he's had four telephone conversations with the president, and the first one he lied to our president when he said he had no intentions of going into Crimea. He's done it, and I suppose maybe he's taken advantage of a lot of ambivalence on the part of Obama when the president draws a line in the sand and that line is crossed, there's no consequences. Then somebody like Putin that wants to put the Soviet Union back together, maybe by inches instead of miles, but Crimea and a couple provinces out of Georgia are a couple examples, you know, you can expect him to push push the Western world as far as he can. And, you know, this is kind of a war on Western values, and we got to think in terms of the United States. Do we want our values or the values of some dictator? So one other point, and then I'll let you ask another question if you want to. But there's a rule of law that's a principle here that we got to hold Russia's feet to the fire. And when I say hold feet to the fire, I know we can't take military action against them. But they signed what's called the Budapest Memorandum in 1995. The U.S., the United Kingdom, and Russia signed this at a time when Ukraine was talked into giving up their missiles, nuclear warfare capability, and all three of these countries promised the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and now Russia has violated that by the invasion of Crimea. So it seems to me, do we want the rule of law? Do we not? And it's Putin really really openly expressing contempt for the United States and Europe when he does that.
Well, and that would be the biggest concern, and I heard some disparaging words today. I can't tell you exactly what they were from Putin about the United States, and that, you know, more or less kind of this is his thing, and if the people supposedly of the Ukraine want this to happen, to just let it happen. And I guess I get concerned when I see us targeted, when, again, is this just a show for the world of what he can do and what the United States can't. I guess that's my question is, what's the end game?
Well, I don't know what the end game is, but in the meantime, to get to the end game, we've got to let, when we say we're going to do something about it, we have to do something about it. And there's a lot of things short of military action, which we wouldn't have the capability of doing at this time anyway. We need to... since Russia is so dependent upon access to Western banks and capital, and they're very dependent upon it, we need to consider restricting that access and freezing assets. 2 years ago, we passed what's called the Magnitsky Act, named after a Russian who was murdered in prison because he was against the Putin regime, and that gives our president the authority for visa restriction and freezing of assets. I think we ought to send some ships to the Black Sea, like Bush did when Putin invaded Georgia. And it's very important that the United States and Europe act together. And there's a lesson to be learned for Chancellor Merkel here of Germany as well, because, you know, back in 2005, she fought to keep Ukraine out of NATO, and Putin praised her for it. You know, if Ukraine had been in NATO, and an attack against one country's attack is something that NATO has to respond to, so the invasion of Crimea would have put NATO treaty into action, Putin wouldn't have done it because he can't afford a war against the West either. But I think now at least Merkel's learned a lesson. She's talking a little more tough right now.
All righty, Senator, we do have a caller standing by. We have Ron on the line. And, Ron, you were on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I'd like to know why we would think that Mr. Putin would follow the rule of law.
You'll have to repeat the question for me because I can't hear the caller.
Caller, could you, Ron, could you repeat that real quick here?
And then you'll still have to repeat it for me.
Okay, Ron, we'll let you go. Senator, I don't know if you heard that, but he said...
I did not hear it, so please repeat it.
Yeah, he said that he doesn't know how we would expect Putin to follow the rule of law when our own president doesn't.
Well, that's the same as saying that when the president draws a line in the sand, when Syria crossed it by using chemical weapons and nothing happens, that shows a weakness on the part of our president and encourages things like what Russian is trying to do. On the other hand, even though it is difficult maybe to get a country that doesn't have respect for the rule of law like we do in the Western world, it's still a principle that if the United Nations and if our treaties are going to mean anything, you have to keep reminding the people that violated the law that they're violating the law, and at least we're letting them know what we stand for.
Senator, what do you think of this? The president, I guess, is trying to organize some kind of a G7 conference. I think it's next week on Ukraine. Is that going to do any good?
Well, it's very important in regard to all this stuff I said about freezing assets and restricting visas and a lot of other things we can do to show Russia that we mean business. It's very important that the United States and Europe act in concert. And so this G7 meeting, along with other countries outside of Europe, is very important. But also, don't forget, G7 has been in existence for maybe 25 years, and just in the last 10 years did Russia get into it, and it's called the Group of Eight. So the Group of Seven meeting without Russia is sending a very clear signal of seven countries to the fact that they don't consider Russia part of the team anymore. And then also for the unification that can come in reaction to what Russia has done.
I want to remind our audience, Senator, that you're joining us today. If they do have a question like Ron had, they can give us a call here, 690-1370, talking with Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. Senator, going to change gears just a little bit here. Talk about this Military Justice Improvement Act. It was something that you were working on, but it is, as far as I know, it looks like we don't have and didn't get the support on that one.
On which act did you say?
The Military Justice Improvement Act.
Oh, yes.
Yep.
That's the one to deal with sexual assault within the military.
Right.
And we did end up passing a bill, but it was much weaker than the one that Senator Gillibrand of New York and I were proposing. And we had the most votes. We had 55 votes, but we didn't have the 60 votes that's necessary to get our bill passed. So the weaker bill by McCaskill passed. And it's weak enough that it doesn't overcome the main purpose of our approach. And our main purpose of the approach was to stop military commanders of units from overriding a judicial process within the military that would find somebody guilty of sexual assault. And it just isn't the fact that the military commander can sometimes do it, because maybe they don't do it very often. But the point is that about 60% of the sexual assaults aren't reported, because there's a real feeling that there'll be harassment if you report a wrongdoing. So we wanted to move it out of the military chain of command and put it in a separate unit within the military, to make sure that people that had crimes committed against them would report it, and number two, after it was reported, people would be prosecuted, and if found guilty, pay the penalty and not have the commander override the court.
And, Senator, we do have another caller standing by. We have on the line, and Frank, you are on the air. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, thank you, Senator, for answering our questions. I just wonder, I've often wondered why they refer to Social Security as an entitlement instead of a trust fund.
Alrighty, Frank.
Okay, he said something about Social Security being an entitlement. Maybe you better repeat that for me.
He wants to know why Social Security is referred to as an entitlement instead of a kind of a lockbox situation that, you know, that you've put money into this. So why is it considered?
Well, because of the way the money is paid out. About 44% of what we appropriate is appropriated out of trust funds because, it's not appropriated. It's paid out of trust funds, and the word entitlement comes from it. If you, in the case of Social Security, if you're the right age and you've got the right number of quarters you've worked, and then you've earned that, and another word for being earned is entitled, so the money just automatically goes out to you, as opposed to the 40% of the budget that Congress actually appropriates every year in separate appropriation bills. Because money that's paid out in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid is not appropriated. Of course, a side of that is that that's one of the reasons we have terrible budget problems and deficit problems, is because about 44% of all the money we spend is not reviewed by Congress every year. And that needs to be done. But it's not something that makes Social Security, the word entitlement, doesn't make Social Security any less the benefit that it is. It's just the language that's used, because the money isn't appropriated. You're entitled to it because you've earned it, and it's paid out automatically.
I always say, Senator, too, if I ran my household budget like the federal government does, I think I'd been in jail years ago.
Well, you mean you don't let your husband spend half of the money without you even knowing about it?
No, I don't. Not in our household.
Okay.
He's probably chuckling at home right now listening to this.
Okay.
But, you know, and as we talk about, you know, as long as we're talking about budgeting and the budget, I don't believe, Senator, unless I missed something, do we have something finally here that we have a real working blueprint that is something that's satisfactory to work off of yet?
Well, it's not. I don't want to say it's satisfactory. We do have a blueprint to work off of, and it was decided just before Christmas for the years 14, which we're in now, and that's final, and 15, which could be changed, but I don't think it will be, because it'd have to be changed before the election. And I don't think people want to be accused of going deeper in debt than we already are by changing it. So before Christmas, it was decided, again, on these appropriated accounts, not the 44% that goes for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, on those 40% that we appropriate, we're going to spend in 14 and 15 about the same level of expenditure that we did in 2009. Now, it's not dollar for dollar for every program, but at $1,016 billion, it's not a whole. It's approximately what was spent in 2009. So that gets us down to a point where the annual deficit is about 3% of gross national product, which is about a 50-year average, and that 50-year average includes paying off $568 billion. On the national debt in the years 97 through 2000. So that blueprint's there. Now, your listeners just heard me talk about 3% of gross national product as a deficit. That isn't going to satisfy the people that said you shouldn't spend more than you take in, and how am I going to disagree with them? But you aren't going to get there overnight.
All righty. Senator, I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about the Health Care Reform Act here. As I recall, we have a March 31st deadline coming up. Is that right, for people to be signed up?
Yeah, to be signed up for this year. Now, come next December, I think it's December, maybe it starts in November, they'll get another chance to change or sign up for the first time. But for if you want to be signed up for this, the rest of this year, you got to sign up by March 31st. Now, we think that the president's going to extend that, just like he 33 times he's changed Obamacare already through his own activity, some of it being illegal. And Senator Harkin even said that when the president changed the beginning of the employer mandate from January 1st, 14 to January 1st, 15, how can the president do that? The law says it starts January 1st, 14. So this isn't just a Republican saying that, but the president's done that 33 times, I think. So he could do it again.
Well, and it begs the question, too, is these deadlines just keep getting moved further and further and further back. It seems, again, there's still some confusion. I think I saw a report out today that there's a third of the people, only a third of people eligible of the low-income folks for signing up for this health care reform and going on these exchanges have actually even signed up. I mean, what's the prognosis? Are they going to get the percentage that they, you know, I mean, we're talking millions of people who haven't signed up, and I think that was what was predicated on how this whole system was going to work.
Yeah.
What happens when these people don't sign up?
Well, there's two things. One, they may not get the number of 7 million that they say they have to have or want, but that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem, even if they get the 7 million, they're only getting about 27% of the people that are ages 25 to 40, the people that don't get sick very often, don't use their health insurance very often, they need 40% of those people to sign up to offset the cost that's going to be to the system and to the health care insurance system for the people 40 to 65 that tend to get sick more often than people 25 to 40. And that's the big danger. It's 27 now. They need 40%. And even if they get the 7 million, they aren't going to get the 40%. So you're going to not have the shifting of costs from young people to older people as much as the president says you need to have to make it a financially sound system.
Well, I want to change gears again. Immigration reform, and we've talked about this over the past few years or so, that keeps getting hot and cold and hot and cold. Is there anything on the horizon here for immigration reform in the near term?
Well, if you'd asked me this question 2 months ago, and maybe you did, I would have thought that the House of Representatives was going to pass a bill. We passed a bill that I voted against because it didn't control the borders, secure the borders. But I'd like to vote for a bill that did secure the borders, because I want to make sure we only let people in the country that are willing to abide by our laws and respect our laws, and crossing the border without papers is disrespect for our laws. But now, 2 months later, it looks to me like the House of Representatives isn't going to take it up. And when, I don't know. Now, you know, if we get a Republican Senate, we'll probably get a bill out of the Senate that I could support, because I think we'll have a better chance of getting a bill that secures the borders. But right now, I think there's a lot of Republicans feel that that with this president not enforcing the immigration laws the way he should, that why pass another bill and give him more authority? If you're going to pass a bill that the president's going to secure the border and he doesn't do what he can to secure the border now, what's the sense of passing more legislation?
All righty. Well, Senator, as always, our half hour goes very quickly, but as always, I appreciate you joining us, and we will talk to you again next month.
Okay. Thank you very much. Goodbye.